It's another gray day here in Southern California. As I have on my warm gray coat, I spotted a few gray geese by the lake. Of course, I'm fond of all the birds here, as they remind me of ancient civilizations, which also revered birds in antiquity. In ancient Greece, the birds were linked to the Phoenician civilization. They did not call themselves that, as Phoenician comes from the Greek word phoinos, which means blood red, which shares the same root with the word phoenix, the mythological bird associated with the sun, resurrection, and rebirth. Also called the firebird in many cultures, legend has it that the creature bursts into flames when it dies, and a new bird then rises from the ashes. Ancient Egyptians linked the bird, which they called Bennu, to immortality. But few realize that both ancient Egypt and Greece were greatly influenced by the Phoenicians, which is the topic of today's episode. The legend of the phoenix is highly symbolic and has its roots in mysticism, which has taken on various definitions in modern times, but in antiquity referred to the belief that spiritual or divine knowledge was accessible directly, usually through some sort of altered state of consciousness, where the intellect was bypassed and the ego, or identification with self, was surrendered or subdued, and one could become one with God or the Absolute during what many describe as a state of ecstasy. The term mystic is derived from the Greek noun mystes, which originally designated an initiation of a secret cult or mystery religion. In classical Greece and during the Hellenistic Age, the rites of the mystery religions were largely or wholly secret. The term mystes is itself derived from a verb mayin, meaning to close, especially the eyes or mouth, and signifies a person who kept a secret. Early Christianity appropriated the technical vocabulary of the Hellenistic mysteries, but later disavowed secrecy, resulting in a transformation of the meaning of mystes. In subsequent Christian usage, mystes or mystic refer to the practitioners of doctrinally acceptable forms of religious ecstasy. During the early times of the religion, many pagan traditions were adapted into Christian symbolism and artwork, and the phoenix represented resurrection. The retelling of the myth compares the bird to that of Jesus Christ. In many relics of the early Catholic leaders, the phoenix is pictured on a palm tree, representing the triumph over death. Incidentally, the phoenix is a genus of 14 species of palms, native to North Africa, the Mediterranean, and the Middle East. Clement of Rome, in the first epistle of the Clement to the Corinthians, makes the earliest known connection of the tale of the phoenix to the fact of the resurrection. Clement writes, quote, "Do we then think it great and remarkable for the Maker of all things to raise up again those that have piously served him in the assurance of a good faith, when even by a bird he shows us the mightiness of his promises? For he says in a certain place, Thou shalt raise me up, and I shall confess unto thee. And again, I laid me down and slept, I awaked, because thou art with me. And again, Job says, Thou shalt raise up this flesh of mine, which has suffered all these things." After Clement of Rome's epistle, the phoenix story was widely applied in the church as a symbol of apotheosis. Think about the story as you hear the baptismal hymn, quote, "Awake, awake, O sleeper, arise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you." As for the date palm, it is commonly believed to have originated from within the Fertile Crescent, part of which became known as the land of Phoenicia. Even if it did not originate there, it was certainly prolific there, as evidenced by the Bible, which calls Phoenicia the land of the palms. Tammuz was the name of the ancient Near East deity who was best known for his sacred sex rites with the goddess Inanna, or Ishtar. Tammuz was known by many titles, including the great source of the date clusters, and Baal Tamar, meaning Lord of the Palms. So we have our first connection between the resurrecting bird and the palm tree. Tammuz was later incorporated into the Hellenic pantheon as Adonis, a beautiful youth who earned the love of Aphrodite. The concepts of death and resurrection are tied to the myth of Tammuz, which foreshadowed the central role of resurrection in the religion of Christianity. In the ancient Sumerian myth about the goddess Inanna, called Lady of the Date Clusters, Inanna plants a halupu tree in her garden, which is likely the date palm, in which a fire-breathing storm bird makes a nest in its boughs. Meanwhile, a serpent that cannot be charmed takes up residence at the root of the tree, and a demon named Lilith makes her home in its trunk. Birds are a symbol of deity the world over. Many cultures believe that gods in the form of birds established their social orders and anointed their rulers. Not every ancient culture told the story of a resurrecting bird like the phoenix, but some did, and fire and immortality are the traits most commonly assigned to the mythological birds. The Chinese, Japanese, and Koreans all have legends about a bird who is immortal. It is red and has long, beautiful tail feathers. It features prominently in folklore about royalty. The use of a dragon and a phoenix in Chinese artwork represents the emperor and the empress. In ancient China, only the empress was allowed to wear the symbol of the phoenix. The Arabs tell of a firebird called Gocnos, which lives in a date palm in the desert. It lays only one egg. The Saudi Arabian national emblem is of a date palm and two swords crossed. That said, the Greeks indicated that the people that they refer to as Phoenicians included a lot more than just the people of the Levant, as their history records that the Phoenician term was applied to the entire eastern Mediterranean, which included the land known as Israel or Judah. While their capital city was in modern Lebanon, where Baalbek is located, which is littered with ancient symbols such as this star, which has been featured on the modern flag of the nation of Israel, Phoenician architecture as well as artifacts also prominently feature the swastika symbol, as can be seen here. The Phoenician Empire had many colonies, which extended across the entirety of North Africa, with one of its most famous and powerful colonies being the city of Carthage in modern Tunisia. In this painting from Pompeii, Dido, also known as Elisa, sits on her throne, surrounded by maids, and on the right we see the personification of Africa, depicted as Caucasian because I'm referring to North Africa, which, like Egypt, is part of the Mediterranean, as opposed to Sub-Saharan Africa, which is separated by thousands of miles of desert. Dido was the legendary foundress of the Phoenician city-state of Carthage. In most accounts, she was the queen of the Phoenician capital of Tyre, who fled from her ruthless brother after discovering that he was responsible for her husband's death, to found her own city in northwest Africa. Her legacy is especially strong in Tunisia, whose women are sometimes called the daughters of Dido, and where she's regarded as a national symbol, even being previously featured on its currency. According to the ancient stories, Dido and her followers arrived on the coast of North Africa, where she asked the Berber king for a small bit of land for a temporary refuge, only as much land as could be encompassed by an ox hide. The king agreed, and Dido cut the ox hide into very fine strips so that she had enough to encircle an entire nearby hill, which became her new home. Many of the local Berbers joined the settlement, but when the new city of Carthage had been established and become prosperous, the native king demanded Dido for his wife, or he would make war on Carthage. Still, she preferred to stay faithful to her first husband and ended up killing herself with a sword. After this self-sacrifice, Dido was deified and was worshipped as long as Carthage endured. In this account, the foundation of Carthage occurred 72 years before the foundation of Rome, which eventually defeated Carthage in the Punic Wars, which is why our Western history is from a Greco-Roman perspective, and almost all of the Phoenician history has been erased or forced to go underground. So, who are these bearded, blue-eyed Carthaginians? Recent DNA sequencing has shown that they shared genetic affinities with Europeans, which should not be surprising given that the archaeological record also places their trade network well into Northern Europe, where some researchers have not only linked the Phoenician alphabet to the Germanic runes, but author L.A. Waddell even published a book called The Phoenician Origin of Britons, Scots, and Anglo-Saxons. When one considers the symbols used and revered by the Vikings and notices their similarity to that of the Phoenicians, then one can make better sense of the recent genomic sequencing, which claims that the Vikings settled Northern Europe from places like Asia, Eurasia, and the southern Mediterranean. Keep in mind that several millennia ago, these places were synonymous with ancient Aryans, which spread out into places like India and Europe, bringing with them their metals, horses, chariots, and languages, such as English, German, and Sanskrit, which are collectively referred to as Indo-European. This diffusion of agricultural civilization, domesticated animals, and advanced metals by a seafaring empire also explains why their symbols and mythology can be seen mirrored in so many seemingly diverse civilizations whose royalty and nobility were anything but diverse in antiquity. I've already discussed in numerous videos about the evidence that the Phoenician Empire extended into North America, as Michigan copper helped to fuel the Bronze Age in Europe. A close examination of Mystery Hill in New Hampshire will also reveal similarities to other archaeological sites used by ancient worshippers of Baal, which is another term used by the Canaanites for Jupiter or Zeus, which traverses the sun's ecliptic over its 12-year orbit, which is the true origin of our zodiac and directly linked to all other solar cults that revere the number 12, regardless of whether they themselves are aware of it or not. Mystery Hill was littered with ancient Phoenician inscriptions, and in Davenport, Iowa, ancient inscribed stone tablets were dug up inside of Native American burial mounds, many of which incidentally contained the remains of men with giant stature, often covered in red ochre, which were published in many newspapers when discovered during the last several centuries, but like the stone tablets themselves, have been labeled as fakes, hoaxes, and anyone that attempts to study them academically is at once labeled with discrimination against Native Americans, who themselves retain legends of ancient tribes of giants, some with red hair, seafaring civilizations, and races of people who were sometimes feared and sometimes revered as gods with a small g. While the Bible speaks of giants roaming the earth in the remote past, so do many other mythologies from around the world, as quoted by the Greek poet Homer in 400 BC, saying, "On the earth there once were giants." or is communicated by Native American tribes, who have a long oral tradition passed down concerning inhabitants with an unusually large demeanor. In fact, it was none other than President Abraham Lincoln who was quoted in 1848 as saying before Congress that, quote, "The eyes of that species of extinct giant whose bones fill the mounds of America have gazed on Niagara as our eyes do now." What was this giant species Lincoln spoke of? A race many presumed to be of a tall, strong, and intellectually sophisticated people. Well, we know that the ancient American landscape was littered with many ancient burial mounds, and while digging, exploring, or legitimate testing in an anthropological context is forbidden these days, this was not always the case. During the last several centuries, the remains of hundreds of giant humans have been discovered on U.S. soil and reported on in a variety of news outlets back before the media was consolidated into the hands of a few. In a time before mainstream archaeology came to subscribe the general public to its Afrocentric view of prehistory, generations prior to when Darwinian theory was turned into a pseudo-religious cult, the American pioneers and early settlers thought that some of the ancient earthworks were not built by the direct ancestors of modern native people living in the historical period, but rather were constructed in a more remote era, encompassing a different social order. They documented their findings in old diaries and letters, carefully written and compiled into pioneer history books, such as these. Quote, "Mastodonic remains are occasionally unearthed, and from time to time discoveries of the remains of Indian settlements are indicated by the appearance of gigantic skeletons with high cheekbones, powerful jaws, and massive frames peculiar of the red man, who left these as the only record with which to form a clue to the history of past ages." The History of Brown County, Ohio. Evidence for the occupation of this region before the appearance of the red man and the white race is to be found in almost every part of the county, as well as through the northwest generally, in removing the gravel bluffs, which are numerous and deep, for the construction and repair of roads, and in excavating cellars, hundreds of human skeletons, some of them of giant form, have been found. A citizen of Marion County estimates that there are about as many human skeletons in the knolls of Marion County as there are white inhabitants at present. The History of Marion County, Ohio. During the colonial and post-colonial era, the settlers diligently gathered as much knowledge of the forgotten past as feasible through native sources. Some of it was woven into romantic stories and songs, but most of it went into records, which, like the accumulation of earth and debris over ancient village sites, became buried in the musty stacks of old libraries, considered to have no real substance in the emerging field of Darwinian doctrine. Quote, "Of the very early history of the region which now embraces Lake County, but little can be written. The mound builders had occupied it and passed away, leaving no written language, and but little even as tradition. These mounds were quite numerous, excavations having revealed the crumbling bones of a mighty race. Samuel Miller, who has resided in the county since 1835, is authority for the statement that one skeleton which he assisted in unearthing was a trifle more than 8 feet in length, the skull being correspondingly large, while many other skeletons measured at least 7 feet. Historical Encyclopedia of Illinois and History of Lake County. James Wofford of the Western Cherokee, who was born in Georgia in 1806, says that his grandmother, who must have been born about the middle of the last century, told him that she had heard from the old people that long before her time a party of giants had once come to visit the Cherokee. They were nearly twice as tall as common men, and had their eyes set slanting in their heads. They said that these giants lived far away in the direction in which the sun goes down. The Cherokee received them as friends, and they stayed some time and then returned to their home in the West, collected by James Mooney. There were mounds situated in the eastern part of the village of Koniet and an extensive burying ground near the Presbyterian Church, which appear to have had no connection with the burying places of the Indians. Among the human bones found in the mounds were some belonging to men of gigantic structure. Some of the skulls were of sufficient capacity to admit the head of the ordinary man, and jawbones that might have been fitted on over the face with equal facility. The other bones were proportionately large. The burying ground referred to contained about 4 acres, and with the exception of a slight angle in conformity with the natural contour of the ground, was in the form of an oblong square. It appeared to have been accurately surveyed into lots running from north to south, and exhibited all the order and propriety of arrangement deemed necessary to constitute Christian burial. Historical Collections of Ohio in 2 volumes. Although not regarded by the government as reliable, the oral traditions of the native people in the U.S. are of the existence of possibly 2 races of giants, one supplanting the other by violent means. Here we have the first inkling of some very remote prehistory preserved through the tradition of the Chippewa, Sandusky, and Tawa tribes, the existence of giant bearded men. Quote, "In this connection, I would say that Mr. Jonathan Brooks, now living in town, stated to me that his father, Benjamin Brooks, who lived with the Indians 14 years and was well acquainted with their language and traditions, told him and others that it was a tradition of the Indians that the first tribe occupying this whole country was a black-bearded race, very large in size, and subsequently a red-bearded race or tribe came and killed or drove off all the Blackbeards, as they called them, the Firelands Pioneer." Many of these accounts have also been published in mainstream newspapers. Let's take a look at some examples. This one is from the New York Times, 1897. Maple Creek, Wisconsin. One of the 3 recently discovered mounds in this town had been opened. In it was found the skeleton of a man of gigantic size. The bones measured from head to foot over 9 feet and were in a fair state of preservation. The skull was as large as a half bushel measure. Some finely tempered rods of copper and other relics were laying near the bones. The mound from which these relics were taken is 10 feet high and 30 feet long and varies from 6 to 8 feet in width. The 2 mounds of lesser size will be excavated soon. Here is another in the New York Times, from Centerburg, Ohio, 1885. Licking County has been for years a favorite field for students of Indian history, there being here 2 old forts and scores of mounds. Last week, a small mound near Homer was opened by some schoolboys who found a skeleton. Today, a further search was made, and several feet below the surface of the earth, in a large vault with stone floor and bark covering, were found 4 huge skeletons, 3 being each over 7 feet in length, and the other 8. The skeletons lay with their feet to the east on a bed of charcoal in which were numerous partially burned bones. About the neck of the largest skeleton were a lot of stone beads, evidently a necklace in life. The grave contained about 80 stone vessels and implements, the most striking being a curiously wrought pipe, the bowl having a series of carved figures upon it resting, a contest between animals and birds. It is said to have been the only engraved stone pipe ever found, a stone kettle holding about 1 gallon, in which was a residue of saline matter, bears evidence of much skill. Their bows, a number of arrows, stone hatchets, and a stone knife are among the implements. The knife is of a peculiar shape, with a curved blade and wooden handle. Students in Indian archaeology claim that it was the most valuable find ever made in that line. This New York Times article is from St. Paul, Minnesota, 1882. The bones of a giant found. A skull of heroic size and singular formation has been discovered among the relics of the mound builders in the Red River Valley. The mound was 60 feet in diameter and 12 feet high. Near the center were found the bones of about a dozen men and women, mixed in with the bones of various animals. The skull in question was the only perfect one, and near it were some abnormally large body bones. The man who bore it was evidently a giant. A thorough investigation of the mound and its contents will be made by the Historical Society. In 1904, the New York Times published this article from New York. While a gang of men in the employ of the New York and Harlem Railroad were taking sand from an immense mound near Purdy Station today to fill an excavation, they unearthed several skeletons of unusual size. The New York Times reported on this find from New Mexico in 1902. Giant skeletons found. Archaeologists to send expedition to explore graveyards in New Mexico where bodies were unearthed, owing to the discovery of the remains of a race of giants in Guadalupe, New Mexico. Antiquarians and archaeologists are preparing for an expedition to further explore that region. The article goes on to describe an ancient burial that has yielded skeletons of enormous size, including curious inscriptions and a frame of 12 feet in length, with a forearm that was 4 feet long, with teeth the size ranging from a hickory nut to that of the largest walnut. The chest of the being was reported as having a circumference of 7 feet, with an anticipation of thousands of more skeletons to be found. This supposition is based on the traditions handed down from the early Spanish invasion that have detailed knowledge of the existence of a race of giants that inhabited the plains of what is now eastern New Mexico. In 1883, the New York Times reported on a story from West Virginia. This time, a Professor Norris examined the remains from a mound located in Charleston, described as 50 feet high, which contained the skeleton of a noted chief at the bottom, measuring 7 feet in length and 19 inches across the shoulders, adorned with artifacts such as copper bracelets. In 1916, the New York Times reports on the find from a mound in Pennsylvania. The mound contained the bones of 68 men with an average height of 7 feet, which were believed to have been buried 700 years ago. The article claims that many of the men were much taller, and some of the artifacts found included massive, oversized stone axes. Some of the remains were said to have been sent to the American Indian Museum, but I couldn't find any physical trace of them, other than what is reported in the article. In 1912, the New York Times published an article about a find in southern Wisconsin. Strange skeletons found, indications that tribe hitherto unknown once lived in Wisconsin. This mound was at Lake Delavan, and when opened, yielded 18 skeletons with massive skulls, reported as much larger than any race living in North America, with sloping foreheads straight back directly above the eye socket, and nasal bones protruding far above the cheekbones. The jaw bones were long and pointed, with female skeletons found as well, which had smaller heads, but with similar facial characteristics. The skeletons were embedded in charcoal and covered over with layers of baked clay. In 1871, the New York Times headline stated, "More big Indians found in Virginia." This time, a cave full of remains were uncovered while working on a railroad, described as a catacomb of skeletons of a remote age, of a lost and forgotten race. The skulls were said to be nearly an inch in thickness. The bones were long, with the femur being the length of the entire leg of an average man, with an estimated height of 8 or 9 feet, with well-preserved teeth described as being as large as a horse's. The San Antonio Express reported on giant skulls recovered near a beach in 1939. This ancient giant skull, about twice the normal size, was found in Victoria County, Texas, believed to be possibly the largest in the United States, or even the world. There's an image of it on the right side, next to normal-sized skulls, which were also found. The newspaper article tells that the giant-sized skull was found in Texas, with confirmation from the University of Texas that a large skull was found in the mound in 1939, but that the skull has been missing from the collection for a long time. The San Diego Union reports in 1947 about traces of giants in the desert. A retired Ohio doctor has discovered relics of an ancient civilization whose men were 8 or 9 feet tall in the Colorado Desert near the Arizona-Nevada-California line, with several well-preserved mummies found in caverns near several tunnels. The giants were reported as wearing garments consisting of jackets, trousers extending slightly below the knees, with a texture resembling gray-dyed sheepskin, but likely taken from an animal unknown today. The Providence Evening Press reports in 1883, reports of what must have been Goliath. This time in Montana, reports of giant skeletons belonging to a prehistoric race, protruding from the banks of a ravine, reported as being close to 12 feet in height, with a 12 to 15 inch head length, with a circumference of 40 inches, and thigh bones measuring 30 inches long. The foot was 18 inches long, and its great toe 3 inches long above the nail. An article from the 1893 edition of The Sun reports on the 8 or 9 feet tall skeletons of supposed mound builders. The mound was opened by the curator of the Carnegie Museum in Pittsburgh, with giant remains reported as being between 8 and 9 feet in height. The mound itself was 12 feet tall and about 100 feet long, estimated as being 400 years old, and created by a prehistoric race that predated the modern American Indians. The torso and portions of the big skeleton were shipped to the Carnegie Museum, but that is the last anyone has heard of them. The St. Paul Globe reported on a giant in 1904. Bones of a giant human skeleton were dug up in Nevada at a depth of about 12 feet underground. Examined by Dr. Samuels, the man stood at nearly 11 feet, with portions of the hand and leg being of a very large proportion. In 1908, the New York Times reported on a find, this time in Mexico. A cave in Mexico gives up the bones of an ancient race. A cave containing some 200 skeletons of men, each above 8 feet in height, evidently a burial place of a race of giants who preceded the Aztecs. One of the skeletons stood at 8 foot 11 inches tall, with molars described as big enough to crack a coconut, and a head that measured 18 inches from front to back. Of course, there are many more examples, and these are not limited to North or even South America, as the New York Times reports in 1892 from Europe. In the year 1890, some human bones of enormous size, described as double the ordinary, were found in England and originally reported by the London Globe. The professor examining the find says the bones belong to a very tall race, abnormal in dimension, and opens the question of the giants of antiquity. Almost as mysterious as the finds themselves is what has happened to all of these remains since being discovered. While many articles claim that the skeletons were shipped to various museums, they cannot be accounted for and seem to have simply vanished sometime after the publications. One cannot simply dismiss them as fabrications or tribal legends, as many of the articles mentioned established doctors and well-known professors as the people measuring the physical skeletons and artifacts. The Smithsonian Institute, easily the world's largest museum complex, began from the generous gift of James Smithson, an English scientist who in 1829, when he passed away, bequeathed his fortune to nephew James Henry Hungerford, with the stipulation that if this man died without an heir, the remainder of the fortune would go to the United States. Hungerford died in 1835, and the Smithsonian officially began in 1846. Mr. Smithson's legacy to the American people was, in his own words, quote, "for the increase and diffusion of knowledge." Unfortunately, it seems that instead of diffusing knowledge, the organization seems to spend a great deal of effort into acquiring or confiscating and storing finds and concealing them, not making them available to the public. In 1882, after some 36 years of growth and accumulating ancient artifacts and remains, the Smithsonian created a Bureau of Ethnology, and a decision was made sometimes after to suppress information, despite the evidence of ancient races that predated the modern-day Native Americans. And this is not restricted to those of gigantic proportions, but include pre-Columbian civilizations reported to have reached the New World, such as the Phoenicians, Egyptians, Hebraic, Greek, Roman, Aryan, Celt, Scandinavian, or even Asian mariners. Evidence was either hidden or destroyed, and discussion of it was considered racially insensitive or supremacist, and not in alignment with the growing sentiment which was developed into the modern Afrocentric fairy tale demanding a strictly African hypothesized origin or supposed simian-based cradle of civilization, despite the fossil or genetic evidence against it. Needless to say, this was an extraordinary assumption, and one that has affected decision-making right until the present day, despite the reality that it has been debunked by many anthropologists, such as myself, that have graduated from accredited universities, yet are censored, deplatformed, suppressed, and outright banned from many mainstream platforms, even those in what are considered fringe or alternative. Which brings us back to what may have been an ancient global empire, established by a people that considered Canaan, or the Levant, as the Holy Land, which the Greeks called Phoenicia, that also had a colony in Britain, as it definitely mined tin from Cornwall. Only a handful of independent anthropologists in the modern era will acknowledge evidence which speaks to this seafaring tribe from the Eastern Mediterranean. Here's an example by Stephen M. Collins, author of The Lost Ten Tribes of Israel.
The Ten Commandments were found in ancient Hebrew on a stone tablet in Ohio. It was dug up in one of the mound builders, mounds that are through the Ohio River Valley. Well, it was dug up in 1860. What it showed was that it was a Semitic grave. And also, even more impressive, is that the Ten Commandments that is carved on a large inscribed stone in New Mexico. On the very highest part of the mountain, there's an inscription saying, Yahweh is our God. And this is the Hebrew from 1200 to 600 B.C., the Paleo Hebrew, where they still wrote what we call the Tetragrammaton, the name of God. And in the rabbinic period, they didn't write that. So you can date it that it clearly goes before that period of time. Well, why aren't these facts in the history books? Now, Britain had been an Israelite colony for about 300 years when Samaria fell. Some tribes sailed for the British Isles. The Samoni, it's in the ancient records of Allen's book, arrived by sea, and he dates it to about 720 B.C. in Wales. The early Welsh called themselves also the Briths or the Brythonic Celts, or Celts. The Phoenicians had been present as miners and as traders, mining tin in that area for many, many years, even before their alliance with the Israelites. The Tuatha de Danann, or part of the tribe of Dan, obviously, arrived as well in the British Isles, principally in Ireland. A lot went a shorter distance to Carthage. But evidence exists that most of the Israelites did not go into captivity, nor did they make sea voyages to new lands, but instead migrated via land and conquered a new homeland in the Black Sea region. In 1875, an official of Queen Victoria's British government, Colonel Gawler, wrote a treatise called Our Scythian Ancestors Identified with Israel, citing many classical and medieval sources that most of the ten tribes migrated north of Armenia and became the Scythians or Sakae of the Greek records by the Black Sea. Ortelius, who was a 16th century geographer for the Spanish king, wrote that when the Israelites migrated into the Caucasus, they took the name Gothi, which the Romans later called Goths. A medieval Jewish writer by the name of Eldad recorded, and I'm going to read his quote in direct quotes here, many Israelites did not go into captivity, but evaded the calamity, going off with their flocks and turning nomads, and that the chief or prince whom they appointed could muster 120,000 horsemen and 100,000 foot soldiers. So with an armed escort of 250,000 men, now if you figure 10,000 for a division, that's quite a few armed divisions going up in terms of armed strength, this mass of Israelites, when you brought your wives and the children with you, the whole mass of people, easily numbered 1 or 2 million, perhaps more. When the Scythians or Sakae were located up in that Black Sea region, of course the Sakae was, again, I just picture the word Isaac, and Sakae is S-A-C-A-E. It has the syllable of Sak, Isaac, or Itzak right in it. Herodotus, the Greek geographer, recorded, of these Scythians, it says that they make no offerings of pigs, nor will they keep them at all in their country. To the extent Scythia is ever discussed in the text, very likely very little, it probably does not mention that they were pretty much kosher in their approach to the meats. Now, the Scythians gave the Israelite names to the rivers that emptied into the Black Sea when they got there. They used to have Greek names like the Ister, the Borysthenes, and I forget Tanae, I think, and I forget the other one. They gave it the names Danube, Dniester, Dnieper, and Don, all of them after the tribe of Dan, right after Israel got there. Now, Herodotus stated that the Scythians were a civilized people. Epiphanius, another Greek, stated that the laws, customs, manners of the Scythians were the standards of civility and polite learning. Now, we are taught in our textbooks that the Greeks and the Romans were the great civilizers, right? I mean, nobody could learn anything unless a Greek or a Roman learned it first, is the general propaganda we get. Many of our textbooks are repeating Greek and Roman propaganda, as I'll get to in just a minute. But this is an example where the Greeks themselves said that the Scythians were the standards of civilized behavior. Where do you think the Greeks got their civilization, or some of many of their civilized activities? From the Scythians. In 528 BC, Cyrus the Great of Persia, who I'm sure you've heard about, attacked the Scythians living near the Caspian and Aral Sea. Persia attacked a main tribe of the Sakae called the Manasseh. Scythia was ruled at that time by a queen. Her name was Tamaris. But this queen was a tough lady, and when Cyrus the Great attacked, she warned him to stay out and told him he would get his fill of blood if he didn't leave. But they tried to keep the peace. Persia was the aggressor. The Scythians said, "Why don't you go back to your own place? We'll live in ours, and let's avoid all this bloodshed." Persia would have none of it. So they attacked. Queen Tamaris led her army against the Persians. Cyrus the Great lost his life. He was killed there. Most of his army was destroyed, which the Greeks record of this battle. The Massagetae utterly crushed the Persian Empire, and yet you hardly hear about them in any of the history books. One thing I do want to mention about this is the eagle was a common Scythian symbol and a clump of arrows being held in the talon of the eagle. Can you think of a modern country in the world that has its eagle crest with a clump of arrows as its war sign? The United States, which I identify as Manasseh, and that was the Massagetae of Scythia, had the same image. Carthage was a crown colony, just like Canada, Australia, New Zealand, you know, were crown colonies of Great Britain when their kings had real power. The priests of Carthage were called the Kohanim, after the Kohens. The term rabbi was noticeable. Historians state that the sacrificial rites bore a very significant resemblance to the book of Leviticus. The Encyclopedia Judaica also acknowledges that Hebrews, or Israelites, from Palestine were with the Phoenicians when they founded Carthage.
Okay, I'd like to interject here. The eagle represents Zeus, also known as Indra, Baal, Jupiter, and is considered the king of the gods because of its path along the ecliptic through the houses of the zodiac. The eagle and phoenix are both associated with the same solar mystery religion, which also includes the Germans, and this should not be confused with politics.
Carthage grew strong and rich. They had such a powerful navy that for centuries they forbid the Greeks and Romans to even go out into the Atlantic. That was their private playground and their private domain, because they exploited the Atlantic world for their own wealth. And Carthage was known as an incredibly wealthy city. Carthage had Gibraltar, or as they called it, the Pillars of Hercules. That's one of the gates of their enemies. Frederick Pohl's book, Atlantic Crossings Before Columbus, quotes two Greek accounts of Carthage's secret Atlantic land. So they learned about it, they just couldn't go see it. One is a fairly respected source, Aristotle. He states, "In the sea outside the Pillars of Hercules, the Carthaginians found a wilderness with navigable rivers. Carthage, the master of the Western Ocean," which meant the Atlantic, "observed that many people attracted by the fertile soil and pleasant climate resided there. Carthage decreed no one else under penalty of death would be allowed to sail there. They kept the land secret." Another Greek writer wrote, there lies a very great island in the vast ocean, many days' sail westward from Africa. The soil is fruitful, a great part of it is mountainous, but there's a large plain watered with several navigable rivers, you know, the Mississippi, the Missouri, the Ohio, etc. The mountainous part is clothed with very large woods. Well, obviously, this is North America, and the Greek histories also record that the Carthaginians sent fleets with tens of thousands of settlers out through the Pillars of Hercules. They assumed they were going to colonies in Africa or Europe, but frankly, there isn't a population base there to indicate that that is where they went. And now, through the work of Barry Fell and the Epigraphic Society, we know a lot of those colonists came to our side of the Atlantic. Carthaginian coins, writings, and artifacts have been found in Colorado, New York, Alabama, Georgia, Connecticut, Nevada, and other places. But why is this fact, why are these facts not in textbooks? Well, obviously it's being suppressed. But the fact is, the Phoenicians and Carthaginians sailed the oceans for centuries. They knew the world was round about a millennium before the Greeks learned it. So we have this myth that the Greeks were the founders of all civilization, when in fact, the Phoenicians and Carthaginians would be just absolutely amazed if they could be resurrected now and see that their ancient propaganda was being taught as facts, because the Greeks got this world is flat notion from a disinformation campaign from the Phoenicians and Carthaginians. They knew the wealth that was out on the other side of the Atlantic and other places. They wanted to scare everybody else away. So they invented those maps you see in the ancient world where it shows these monstrous sea creatures that would just gobble ships, you know. So the Carthaginians invented that to scare their enemies off the ocean so they could have a monopoly. And they understood latitude and longitude. They knew how to navigate with the trade winds and the currents back and forth across the oceans with no difficulty. But the Greeks, for example, were so ignorant of this that at one point the Carthaginian navy, which usually blocked the Pillars of Hercules, was gone on a war. A Greek sailor from Marseille, France, named Pythias, sailed through the Pillars of Hercules and started going north in the direction of Britain. He was absolutely amazed to see that the constellations changed position in the sky further north he went. He went back and told the Greek world, the earth must be round. The positions of the stars is changing. It's like I'm sailing on a sphere going, you know. They all laughed him to scorn and said, no, of course, you know, it's flat. And so that's where our great Greek civilization also was deceived by the Carthaginians. Well, Carthage did have an entire civilization here. Historians discuss two mysterious civilizations in ancient America, the Adena people, who inhabited the Ohio River Valley. They can identify from about 1000 B.C., onward. Now, that's the time of King David and Solomon, when they were sending fleets across the ocean until they merged with the Hopewell people around 300 to 200 B.C. They died out centuries later, but 300 to 200 B.C. is a key time as well. That's the time of the Punic Wars, when the Carthaginians were losing to the Romans and more of their people left for their colonial system as refugees. The presidents Jefferson and Harrison, what about the mound builders? They were wondering if these weren't built by the lost tribes of Israel.
Modern-day academics that rely on federal funding for their paychecks reject transatlantic voyages to the New World from the Phoenicians, Minoans, Maritime Archaic, or Red Paint People, as they're commonly called, and refuse to consider evidence linking the Clovis culture of the New World to people of Western Europe known as the Solutrians, based on a similar bifacial stone tool technology, claiming that the peopling of the Americas could only happen by foot over the Alaskan land bridge and not by sea. They discount the notion of lost tribes, as it's perceived as being politically insensitive to acknowledge prior cultures or civilizations that predate the modern Native American tribes, and it goes against their established worldview. That said, the archaeological evidence points to numerous waves of settlement of the Americas on both coasts by a wide variety of races, including what the modern natives themselves refer to as giants, which seems to predate the narrative put forth in Western schools by many millennia. Forming a cluster off the California coast are eight remote islands, the Channel Islands, which over a span of 13,000 years have continued to reveal a vast and sometimes mysterious past. One of these islands, Santa Catalina Island, located 22 miles from Long Beach, or an hour by ferry, is known by many as Catalina Island, and features a human population of over 4,000 people today. The island was claimed by Spain in 1542, and later it passed into possession of Mexico, and after that to the United States, and eventually turned into a tourist resort in the 1920s by the tycoon William Wrigley Jr. of the Chewing Gum Empire. Although the island is now a popular tourist destination and frequently visited by vacationers from nearby Los Angeles, which lies only about an hour ride away, there's another odd facet of the island's history that most people may be unaware of. Historical claims report that Ralph Glidden, a self-taught archaeologist who moved to Catalina Island with his parents as a boy, uncovered ancient burial sites in the early part of the 20th century. He is said to have excavated more than 800 secret grave sites from various locations around the island, including thousands of artifacts and 4,000 human skeletons. Glidden claimed that a giant and fair-haired race with adult males measuring 7 to 9 feet in height once inhabited Santa Catalina and its adjacent islands. In the Ogden Standard Examiner, November 10th, 1929 edition, it was written, "Glidden claims overwhelming proof that a fair-skinned, fair-haired, highly intelligent race of a great stature lived on Catalina Island off the southwestern coast of California, perhaps 3,000 years ago, and that his excavation of a huge cache of skeletons, domesticated utensils, urns, wampum, etc., is quite out of the ordinary class of Indian discoveries. A skeleton of a young girl, evidently of high rank, within a large funeral urn, was surrounded by those of 64 children, and in various parts of the island, more than 3,000 other skeletons were found, practically all the males averaging around 7 feet in height, one being 7 feet 8 inches from the top of his head to his ankle, and another being 9 feet 2 inches tall. There are other similar stories about such skeletons being found on Santa Rosa Island, one of the Channel Islands right off the coast of Southern California. The Arlington Springs Man is the name given to a set of late Pleistocene, or Ice Age, remains discovered on Santa Rosa Island. The Arlington Springs archaeological site is protected, and as usual, independent investigation is not permitted, but the man who excavated the remains in 1959 was the late Phil C. Orr, curator of anthropology and paleontology at Santa Barbara Museum of Natural History, and he claimed a race of fair-haired giants inhabited the islands, stating that he believed the remains to be over 10,000 years old. At the time, radiocarbon dating techniques were still being developed, so that determining an accurate age for the human bone protein was not possible. Nonetheless, Orr realized that the bones, buried 37 feet below the existing ground surface, came from sediments dated to the end of the Pleistocene. The Arlington Spring Man was later re-examined in 1989 by Orr's successors at the museum, and their initial results indicated that the Arlington Springs Man was actually the Arlington Springs Woman, with radiocarbon dating determining the date of the remains to be 13,000 years old. These remains represented the oldest reliably dated human bone in the Americas. That said, after further study, they reversed their gender assessment in 2006, concluding that the remains were more likely those of a man, and the name Arlington Springs Man was reinstated. During the last ice age, the four northern Channel Islands were held together as the one mega island of Santa Rosa, as the sea levels were much lower, but not so much that the island was connected to the mainland, indicating that the ice age people, or giants, had watercraft capable of crossing the Santa Barbara Channel, which also lends credence to the coastal migration theory for the peopling of the Americas during the Pleistocene, using boats to travel from other various landmasses. According to numerous written and oral legends of Native American tribes, a race of white giants has existed in the distant past, and in some cases, the tribes have maintained some empirical evidence. According to Paiute Indian oral legends, a tribe called the Sitika were a tribe of tall, red-haired giants that once occupied the area in the distant past. Amazingly, 9,400-year-old mummified remains were indeed found in a cave in Nevada, and while controversial private testing was published in this case, independent scientific study is not allowed on the remains for political reasons, and only a drawing of a photograph of the remains is permitted. Sarah Winnemecca Hopkins, a prominent female Native American activist, educator, and daughter of Paiute Chief Winnemecca, related many stories passed down in her tribe firsthand about the Sitika in her book Life Among the Paiutes, published in 1883. Quote, "My people say that the tribe we exterminated had reddish hair. I have some of their hair, which has been handed down from father to son. I have a dress which has been in our family a great many years, trimmed with the reddish hair. I'm going to wear it sometime when I lecture. It's called a mourning dress, and no one has such a dress but my family." Her book also tells of an alliance between the various tribes to help Paiutes in defeating a group of giants with red hair who had taken refuge in Lovelock Cave. A large fire was set at the entrance of the quarry to get them out, but the giants refused, so it was that many of them died of suffocation and others burned alive. In the early 20th century, archaeologists found thousands of artifacts and, as I said, skeletal remains inside the Lovelock Cave to show that it was not a mere myth and that the Paiutes told the truth.
For more than a century, a story has persisted about the skeletons of giants being found in Lovelock Cave in northern Nevada.
And for many years, human remains were put on display in museums here and elsewhere, but that changed. Most of the bones and skulls that were once considered to be historical artifacts have been returned to tribes for burial.
If oversized bones from the so-called Lovelock giants ever existed, they are no longer available to the public. But their story behind the legend still remains.
The I-Team's George Knapp has more.
Slicing through the bone-dry Humboldt sink on a long dirt road, it's hard to imagine that all of this was once underwater. Remnants of a vast ancient lake can still be seen in the distance. For generations of first Americans, this was a lush paradise of tules, fish, and waterfowl. Humans have climbed this same narrow path up the jagged mountain for more than 4,000 years. That's how long indigenous peoples lived in and around the Lovelock Cave. The roof of the cave is still coated with soot from countless campfires. According to tribal lore, a race of red-headed giants made its last stand in this cave.
Among the Paiutes, would most of them say that the giants were real?
All that I've talked to say yes. I've never heard anybody say no.
Devoy Monk has spent all of her 80-plus years in Lovelock. Her family's home today houses a small museum, jam-packed with artifacts and depictions documenting centuries of Native culture and pioneer life. Monk has earned the trust of Paiute elders who say the stories are true, that the red-headed interlopers not only killed but ate their ancestors.
My Indian friends tell me they were cannibals, that they set traps, and we have a paper in the other room, that they dug holes in the pathways and where they walked and then covered them, and then the Indians would fall in, and they said the best part to eat were the thighs.
Famed Nevadan Sarah Winnemucca first wrote in her acclaimed book that the Paiutes waged a three-year war against a tribe of red-headed cannibals before trapping and then killing the last of them inside Lovelock Cave. Mainstream archaeologists have vigorously rejected the entire story, to the point that the State Museum in Winnemucca admonishes visitors at its front entrance that the red-headed giants are a myth. Bill Snodgrass, the curator of the Marzen House Museum in Lovelock, thinks there is reasonable basis for parts of the story. In the early 20th century, guano miners began excavating the Lovelock Cave and uncovered thousands of artifacts, along with mummified remains, including a few specimens much taller than the typical Paiute of centuries past. Later, scientific excavations found troves of native antiquities, along with bones. Some human remains were destroyed destroyed. Others were sent to museums for display. A few, Snodgrass says, were consumed in bizarre initiation rituals. He adds there is evidence, including basketry, of an unknown culture that lived near the cave. Records show some of them had red hair.
There was definitely a different people here.
Many, if not most, of the visitors who end up at the Marzen House Museum have questions about the red-headed cannibals. The locals still enjoy the debate.
Whether the red-headed giants ever existed, visits to the two museums are worth the drive up to Winnemucca and Lovelock. The Lovelock Cave is in Churchill County, off the beaten path, but not hard to find.
A mummy has been discovered, a mummy that may reveal the secrets of an even older society, one that dates back to the dawn of civilization.
This is extremely significant. This is unprecedented. We haven't had a find of this importance in my lifetime.
One thing that makes the mummy, known as the Spirit Caveman, so important are these fine hand-woven fabrics discovered at the burial site.
These textiles represent an extremely sophisticated ability to weave fabric by hand in a time where we didn't realize that people were doing that before.
The mummy was discovered tightly bound up in this matting. Out of respect for the dead, this photograph and this drawing are the only two pictures scientists will allow to be publicly displayed. Recent tests reveal that the mummy is 9,000 years old. That's three times older than any other mummy yet discovered in North America. That news has stunned archaeologists, because a mummy can tell scientists how people back then lived, what diseases they had, even what food they ate. Scientists can get that information by studying the mummy's DNA. That requires cutting a small piece of tissue from the body.
And it shouldn't be done.
And that, says Paiute Shoshone tribal leader Alvin Moyles, is desecrating the dead. The mummy was discovered near Paiute Shoshone land. Moyles believes the mummy's spiritual journey has been disturbed and that the spirit cannot find peace until the body has been properly reburied.
You are bothering the spirit. They're not to be bothered. They're put to rest, and that's where they should be left.
But scientists claim that the mummy is so old that he couldn't possibly be related to the Paiute Shoshones, that the mummy's tribe was here thousands and thousands of years before anybody else.
They do not appear similar to any living Native American in North America. They have receding cheekbones, narrow face, long face. Some Indians have some of those traits, but as a group, those are Caucasoid traits.
The two sides are now caught in a catch-22. One way to prove kinship is through the DNA test, but the tribe doesn't want that because it would require further disturbance of the remains.
The DNA evidence would be definitive for ruling out certain groups. You can't necessarily prove with it which group it was, but you can rule out contending parties.
Until a decision can be made, the mysterious Spirit Cave mummy will remain trapped in limbo.
Yeah, he's kind of in the legal, spiritual, ethical limbo.
In Carson City, Nevada, Vince Sterla, Channel 3 reports.
Even mummies can't avoid the law and bureaucracy, it appears. Many archaeologists agree it's entirely possible the mummy is not related to any existing tribe in North America.
Yeah, it sounds like the mummy predated most of the Indian tribes from
sounds
that part of the country.
With archaeological sites pushing human occupation in Mexico to over 30,000 years, many researchers are giving myths and legends from South America another look. Patagonia is a region in southern Argentina and Chile, extending from the Andes to the Atlantic, and there are many accounts of a legendary race of extremely tall people that were first mentioned by Ferdinand Magellan and his crew, who claimed to have seen them while exploring the coastline of South America in the 1520s. Antonio Pigafetta, a crew member and chronicler of Magellan's expedition, wrote about their encounter, and I quote, "One day we suddenly saw a naked man of giant stature on the shore of the port, dancing, singing, and throwing dust on his head. The captain general sent out one of our men to the giant so that he might perform the same actions as a sign of peace. Having done that, the man led the giant to an islet where the captain general was waiting. When the giant was in the captain general's and our presence, he marveled greatly and made signs with one finger raised upward, believing that we had come from the sky. He was so tall that we reached only to his waist, and he was well proportioned." The captain named these people Patago in Portuguese and Patagon by his men in Spanish, traditionally said to be from pata, meaning foot. However, the gon suffix remains unexplained and was interpreted to mean land of the big feet. Many other accounts of giants in South America followed, and in 1579, Sir Francis Drake's ship chaplain, Francis Fletcher, wrote about encountering very tall Patagonian natives, saying that, and I quote, "Magellan was not altogether deceived in naming them giants, for they generally differ from the common sort of men, both in stature and strength of body, as also in the hideousness of their voice. But yet they are nothing so monstrous or giant-like as they were reported." He reduced the height of the Patagonians from 10 feet to 7.5 feet. In the 1590s, William Adams, an Englishman aboard a Dutch ship grounding Tierra del Fuego, reported a hostile encounter between his ship's crew and abnormally tall and powerful natives. In 1766, Captain John Byron had circumnavigated the world, and word had leaked that the crew had seen 10-foot-tall giants in South America, the official account of Byron's voyage appearing in 1773, and I quote, "When we came within a little distance from the shore, we saw, as near as I can guess, about 500 people, some on foot, but the greater part on horseback. One of them, who afterwards appeared to be a chief, came towards me. He was of a gigantic stature, and seemed to realize the tales of monsters in a human shape. If I may judge of his height by the proportion of his stature to my own, it could not be much less than 7 feet. Mr. Cummings, one of Byron's officers, came up with the tobacco as a gift, and I could not but smile at his astonishment, which I saw expressed in his countenance, upon perceiving himself, though 6 feet 2 inches high, become a pygmy among giants, for these people may indeed more properly be called giants than tall men, the shortest of whom were at least 4 inches taller." In his book, History of the Indians, Choctaw, Chickasaw, and Natchez, from 1899, Horacio Bardwell Cushman wrote, quote, "The tradition of Choctaw, a race of giants once lived in the state of Tennessee, and with which their ancestors had to fight when they arrived in Mississippi in their migration from the West. The tradition says that the individuals of the giant breed, known as Nuhulu, possessed an impressive stature." Cushman noted that over time, the term Nuhulu became common to refer to all white giants with which the Choctaws fought after crossing the Mississippi River. According to the story from 1857, the Comanche chief, Rolling Thunder, said, quote, "Many moons ago, a race of tall white men, 10 feet tall, and much more rich and powerful than any white person living now, who inhabited a large part of the country, stretching from dawn to dusk, their fortifications were crowning the tops of the mountains, protecting their cities located in the intermediate valleys. They exceeded all other nations in all kinds of trades. They were smart and brave individual warriors who ruled the land they had wrested from their former owners. The pale faces today would look like pygmies compared to the giants, both in their art and in their arms. In the opinion of the Comanche chief, the Great Spirit destroyed them when they forgot all about justice and mercy, becoming too proud." The Navajo is another ancient tribe that provides evidence of white giants they call the people of Starnak, describing them as a race of white giants, the largest mining technology that had built strongholds along the Americas that dominated the West, enslaving the smallest tribe. Eventually, the mysterious Starnak became extinct, or back in the heavens. In Aztec mythology, giants were the builders of the cities of Teotihuacan. The inhabitants reported that, at the time of the Spanish conquest, they themselves had killed the last giants on earth. In the ancient city of Manta in Peru, they speak of a race of giants who, in the past, coexisted with them. Their legends say they came from the coast in large boats, as large ships, a group of men of a size such that its height was almost twice the size of a normal man. Their limbs were all in proportion, and it was monstrous to see their heads with hair that reached behind them. Their eyes were as big as small dishes. In folklore from all over Europe, giants were believed to have built the remains of previous civilizations. While beards were traditionally part of many ancient European civilizations, and by extension, the ancient Middle East, North Africa, and Eurasia, as they once shared the same ethnic demographic, they were certainly not wild ape men, and while they were described as hairy in early accounts by various tribes they encountered that often lacked facial hair themselves, they were usually then deified and responsible for the world's earliest examples of agriculture, megalithic stone monuments, architecture, clothing, metal, domesticated animals, and were absolutely seafaring. It seems logical then, given the evidence and lack thereof, that the hunt for the mythical Bigfoot should not be a search for a tall, primitive, simian creature, like an upright walking gorilla, but for the last possible remnants of a lost, forgotten race, highly intelligent, whose global civilization underwent major catastrophe, who were humbled by what appears to be a periodic cataclysm that afflicts the earth after long intervals, and from which we ourselves suffer a collective amnesia. It could be that the myth of Bigfoot may have a lot more in common with other ancient legends, such as the long-haired, bearded gods of mythology, the Titans of Atlantis, or even the giants of the Bible. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon, as well as through various other major book outlets. They make a great gift. If you'd like to support my work, you could do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description section for those that are interested. I appreciate it. Thank you. Please hit the like button and subscribe for future updates. As always, I look forward to reading your comments, so please leave me your thoughts below. Please have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.